Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It would seem that Trump can't make up his mind to continue the war he started with Israel on Iran or pursue renewed negotiations. The problem is the U.S. military does not have the means to continue the conflict, and Iran is unlikely to accept any proposal from Trump. Iran has all the cards. Crosstalking Endless War, I'm joined by my guest David Swanson in Charlottesville. He is an author, activist, as well as executive director of worldbeyondwar.org. And in Montreal, we cross to Dimitri Laskatos. He is a lawyer and a freelance journalist. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. David, let me go to you first here. What do you make of what's going on right now? We had this two-week period of tit-for-tat. Trump was going to open up the gates of hell. And then he tacoed again. And, you know, all this focus is on the messaging coming out of the White House and their acolytes in the media like Fox News. It seems to me that the only thing that they spend most of their time on is a messaging control while the world moves on. And obviously, given the last 18 months of so-called negotiations with Iran, the Iranian leaders have no interest, and there's no reason why they would have any interest in continuing any kind of dialogue with the United States. So where are we right now? Is this war going to continue on, or is there an ending in sight, or maybe something in between? I don't know. David.
Well, I wish I saw an ending in sight. I don't. If I ever do, I will not call it chickening out. I think it takes more courage in Washington, D.C. to stand up to the media and the Congress and the weapons dealers than to engage in escalations of wars. Everybody loves those. And so I don't characterize that as chickening out if there's restraint. In fact, it's shameful that the so-called opposition party denounce any sort of deal that might end the thing because that deal would be dramatically worse than never having started the thing. But that's typical of wars. The question is, would the deal be worse than continuing the thing? And of course, it would not. And so a deal needs to be made. But as you say, why would the Iranian government trust the U.S. government at this point? And why would Trump be willing to make a deal when everyone is screaming at him, not for the mass murder, not for the blowing up of schools and houses, but for threatening to end it with a bad deal? And so, you know, this is horrible amateurish war marketing, right? This is worse than we're going to find giant weapons of mass destruction that they know they're about to not find. This is starting a war and immediately making it be about something that happened because of starting the war, namely the closure of the strait, you know, and so there's not a way out of that that makes Trump look good. But the alternative of continuing and escalating and risking global escalation, frankly, the U.S. military does have the capacity and the weaponry and the funding to do that. You have a so-called opposition Congress passing resolutions in each house, alternatively, never together, to tell Trump to end the war, which is very, very unpopular in the United States. But he would veto if they ever got their act together and both houses did it at once, he would veto it and they wouldn't override it, while at the same time, both parties making very, very certain that they do not block a massive military spending bill. It's, you know, talked about as 1.5, 1.6 trillion. A recent study made clear it's actually closer to $3 trillion when you include debt payments and veterans and so forth. And there's this debate going on about tens of billions of dollars for the war on Iran, while they're throwing trillions around. And they use that money for all kinds of wars, including the war on Iran. So they're not out of money. They're not out of weapons. They're out of morality. They're out of courage. They're out of decency.
Well, at the very least, they're out there. They don't have a strategy, okay? Dimitri, I think it's as we speak right now, Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, is making his seventh visit to Donald Trump in this his term in office right now. I don't know what they're going to agree or disagree on, but I think given the past, when has Donald Trump said no to Netanyahu?
Well, I know that there is a popular view out there. I myself used to ascribe to it that the Israelis control U.S. foreign policy in this part of the world.
Well, Dimitri, you know, do they control Donald Trump? That's a different question. Go ahead.
That's true. That is a different question. So let's focus on that question. Donald Trump has been saying for decades that he wanted to take out Iran. This did not start, you know, in the past few years. There are recordings of him expressing that fervent wish, I think going all the way back to the 1980s or something. This has been a longstanding goal of the entire U.S. foreign policy elite, and particularly the neocon branch of the U.S. foreign policy elite.
But Donald Trump did it. That's different, too.
Well, he did it, yes, but why did Donald Trump do it? First of all, his predecessors set the stage. Let's be very clear about that. They set the stage, for example, by imposing or continuing crushing sanctions on Iran. They set the stage by, it was under Biden, I believe, that the Israelis attacked the Iranian consulate or embassy in Damascus.
In Damascus.
Which was an act of war. And I think that that's actually what precipitated the first round of direct hostility between Iran and Israel. That happened under Biden. And then there was this fraudulent deal that Obama struck with Iran, the JCPOA, which Iran complied with, and then Obama didn't. He didn't actually lift the sanctions. So this has been going on for decades. Why did Donald Trump do it? I think it has a lot to do with the fall of Syria. Syria's government finally fell, and that was an important link in the axis of resistance. Plus, Hezbollah and Ansar Allah had taken some heavy blows. They're still very effective in terms of resisting, but they had taken heavy blows. And I think the U.S. foreign policy elite adjudged that now was the time, that Iran was isolated to a degree and weakened to a degree. They actually believed that they were going to be able to overthrow the Iranian government. I think they genuinely believed that, the Israelis and the U.S. So they miscalculated. But this is a longstanding goal, and I don't buy that Trump is basically being ordered by Netanyahu to do this. I think that that is quite a charitable view of Donald Trump's.
Again, you know, we have to parse our words here. Being ordered to do something and not being able to say no. Maybe I'm quibbling over words here. David, do you want to chime in on that? I mean, because, I set up my question. Every time Netanyahu goes to Washington, Trump seems to get something from Trump. How do you see it?
Well, these are wars on Gaza, on Iran, on Lebanon, on Yemen that are supported by the government of Israel, by Netanyahu, are also supported by the establishment in Washington, D.C., by the weapons dealers, by the U.S. corporate media. Everyone wants these. But when Trump or Biden or their predecessors pretend to stand up to Netanyahu on something like Gaza while sending them buckets of weapons, you know, I think the satirical magazine The Onion has it right when they put up a headline, "Trump sends Netanyahu strongly worded check," because it's always more money, more money, more weapons, well, shame on you, you must stop it, you know, and so it's hard to believe that you must stop it bit while they continue to send the weapons. And so when they say—
But David and Dimitri, I mean, I'm not sure we're actually disagreeing here, but David, this is undermining, if not destroying, Trump's presidency.
Well, it is. That's not something new. That's not something that Lyndon Johnson didn't do, that that Woodrow Wilson didn't do, that that we didn't see the first President Bush do. Presidents love wars, and they love them more than being president. Kamala Harris loved the war on Gaza more than becoming president, like Hubert Humphrey, like so many before them, and like Hillary Clinton. And so we have, you know, four or five times where there was this big, urgent push for the war on Iran, that it was stopped, by public pressure, by pressure within the establishment in Washington. And yes, as Dimitri said, it builds up and they take steps. And I think the Iran agreement, not only did the U.S. not comply with it, not only was it never a treaty or a thing of law, but also both sides argued for it with the same lies, right? We must have a war because Iran is going to get nukes and kill us. No, we must have this agreement because Iran is going to get nukes and kill us. Nobody's saying that it was all a bunch of lies.
Yeah, but Dmitry, it doesn't really matter the reason the establishment wanted war against Iran. It got it, and Donald Trump went along with it. That's how I would characterize it. It's never been about Iran must never have a nuclear weapon. It's never been that, okay? It is regime change, Dmitry.
Oh, I think it's more than regime change, my friend. I think that ultimately the goal here is the destruction of Iran.
Okay, the same thing. Okay, I agree with that. Sure, of course.
The reason why I say that is because the Americans have learned the hard way that even if you have a vassal in Tehran, that vassal might get overthrown and replaced by a revolutionary government. So,
it happened, right?
Correct,
exactly.
Correct.
Right.
And they know if by some miracle they managed to insert Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah, for some brief period of time, he almost certainly would be overthrown too. I mean, the guy wouldn't last more than a year, if a month. And so they want to prevent there from being any form of resistance anywhere in West Asia to U.S. domination. This is why there's a genocide happening in Palestine and Lebanon. This is why they've been attacking Yemen. They're trying to snuff out, physically exterminate all opposition to U.S. hegemony in the region. Yep. Why? Because their power is on the decline globally, and this is their last gasp at maintaining some level of dominance in the world because of the oil resources of the region, the fact that it's a nexus between Europe, Africa, and Asia, the trade routes and so forth. That's what this is. It's a naked power grab. And it's really important, Peter, that we get this right. This has major implications, not just for Iran. We need to understand what the objectives of the U.S. government are. And if we misdiagnose the problem and say it's because, you know, whatever the words are you want to use, undue influence over Trump or Zionism or the lobby, if we think that's the cause of the problem, we're going to fail to address the problem. The problem is that the entire U.S. foreign policy elite is hell-bent on war and domination.
All right, Dmitry,
I just want to add one thing.
Hang on. No, this is exactly what we're going to talk about in the second half of the program. Okay. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that break, we'll continue our discussion on endless war. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVelle. And we're discussing endless war. Okay, let's go back to Dmitry in Montreal. Unfortunately, I had to interrupt you as we were going to the break here. But you were saying we have to get this right. And really what I wanted to talk about on this part of the program, is this the beginning of the end of Pax Americana? Because the American security umbrella is being shown to be, well, and not what it's being, not as what it was sold to be. All of these entangling alliances the United States have. I don't think that the monarchies in the Persian Gulf are going to want to have a rerun of this. I mean, my point is here is the entire premise of Pax Americana is being undermined and changed. And I think that's a good thing. Dmitry, continue.
Well, to go back to what I was saying about the orientation of the U.S. foreign policy elite, I often talk about this, and it's very important. There was a most remarkable speech given by Eisenhower as he exited the White House in 1961. He warned of the rise of the military-industrial complex and said this was a situation that was unprecedented in U.S. experience, and this threatened to undermine democracy such as it existed in the time of the United States. What then happened? Anybody who sought detente in the U.S. political establishment, for example, JFK, his brother, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, anyone who sought peace and detente with the official enemies of Washington was snuffed out. I don't think this was coincidental. I personally don't buy the narratives around their assassinations. And by the way, a majority of Americans don't either. What eventually happened was that the military-industrial complex took over the U.S. government. It has hijacked it, and it is now metastasized like a cancer throughout the West. And we're seeing this with this ridiculous, absurd, ruinous increase in military spending to 5% of GDP throughout NATO. This is going to destroy a social democracy throughout the West and eventually bankrupt these countries. And this is what's happened. So we need to understand that. And if we don't address the fundamental problem, which is that the U.S. government and other Western governments have basically been hijacked by the military-industrial complex. We're not going to bring an end to these wars. To answer your question, Peter, yes, from a moral perspective, if the United States Pax Americana is dead as a doornail, the whole world can now see, virtually the entire world, that this was a fraud from the outset. The problem is that the United States continues to have enormous destructive capabilities.
That's true.
And is willing to spend insane amounts of money, far more than any other state, on arming itself and inflicting a severe suffering on innocent populations around the world, destabilizing entire regions, threatening nuclear war. It has that capacity, and we shouldn't be too triumphalist too early. From a moral perspective, the United States has been, its government has been completely exposed. But it still retains enormous destructive capacity.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, this is a fascinating conversation. David, you already mentioned the budgets that are being directed towards military spending. But at the same time, in looking at the conflict against Iran, a war of choice on the part of the United States and Israel, you still can come to the conclusion that there are limitations on the use of military force, even though it's lavishly funded, because the United States and Israel have not got the military outcome that they've wanted with Iran. So how do you square that? I mean, these lavish budgets, but unable to defeat militarily a country like Iran.
Well, hardly ever has anyone gotten out of a war what they wanted to get out of it or claimed they wanted to get out of it. This is nothing new, but I think we have to follow the money. And when people said Trump is going to be the peace candidate and the peace president and said it again after he wasn't the first time, I had to say, follow the money. This guy wants massive, unimaginable, unprecedented money moved from everything else, from healthcare and retirement and education and parks and streets and transportation. And he wants all the other countries to do it too, and he wants to make it measurable as part of an economy, as GDP, as if it's to be maximized as a public good. And this is what they're doing. And they're doing it at a time when they've got somebody stupid enough, somebody to believe the overthrow fantasies, somebody to believe even the genocidal will exterminate them all fantasies and act on it, which they didn't have before. I mean, all the underlings in Washington, you know, fail upward as they are. The more belligerent they are, the more they succeed. But there's supposed to be somebody at the top, somewhat answerable to the public, who puts some restraint on that. And there isn't. There finally isn't. And, you know, this is the most quickly least popular war since public polling has been done in the United States, and they do not apparently care. And they are crowing about a supposed success in Venezuela, where to a remarkable extent, they got what they said they would get, which almost never happens. They're claiming imperial success. They overthrew the country, took it over. Marco Rubio runs the place right now. They destroyed the rule of law. They destroyed morality. They destroyed the natural environment. There's going to be blowback coming from Venezuela and so on. But they're talking about a success. They got more money than anybody before ever dreamed of. I've heard the empire was on its dying breath, you know, my entire life, and I'm not that young. The problem is that we all see that wars must end. We all see that wars don't get what they claim they're going to get, but they don't see it, and they don't have the motivation to see it, and it could go the other direction. And the doomsday clock is set closer to midnight than ever before because of not just the war in Ukraine, but these other wars as well. And now they're trying to merge the two wars and get Ukraine and Iran to be a single war, so the U.S. is in on both of them, and they got the two presidents there mourning and weeping for Lindsey Graham in Washington, D.C., because they're all on the same side of more war.
You know, Dmitry, I found, you know, I'm glad that David brought it up. I mean, Zelensky's order to attack an Iranian ship in the Caspian Sea. And obviously, this is at least, at the very least, to get Trump's attention. Look, I'm on your side. I'm on your side. You got to help me out more. But, I mean, it is kind of interesting that the very thought of merging these wars together, because it sends a very definite message to the Russians and the Chinese, as well as the Iranians, is that there is you can't negotiate with the West. You can, particularly with the United States. It's always a one-way street, and if an agreement is made, it's always broken. And so that should be a wake-up call for all. It doesn't matter if the United States experiences a defeat temporarily in the Persian Gulf. It's not going to change its stripes. Its DNA is the way it is, and if it's going to fall, it'll have to fall totally. There's going to be no compromise. Dimitri.
Oh, I think that's quite right. Unless until the U.S. economy lies in smoking ruins, then you might see some real compromise when there's been real deterrence established. But just to go back to what you said about Ukraine, and I think this is a really good example of how we need to get this right. The way you couched this, Peter, it sounded like you're of the view, and I may be mistaken in this, that Zelensky was acting on his own initiative. I personally believe that is almost certainly not the case. I think he was directed by Washington to do this. Zelensky is entirely dependent on intelligence from Washington, armaments, even though they're being paid for by the Europeans now, coming from the United States principally. And when he is existentially dependent upon a foreign power, as he is on Washington, he's not going to mess with their war in a way that doesn't jibe with Trump's agenda. So this is not highly unlikely to have been done without at least the acquiescence of the U.S. government, if not the outright direction.
You know, Dimitri, I'm not going to disagree with you, but there's also reports, and not just from, not from Western media, for sure, that they thought it was a Russian ship, okay? What I'm just saying, at the very least, he's being an opportunist, but I'm not going to push back about what you just said. On an intelligence level, the Ukrainians don't have that kind of capacity. But nonetheless, there's a lot of opportunism here as well. Keep going, Dimitri.
Yes, and so also the nearest border of Ukraine is more than 700 kilometers away from the Caspian Sea. So
exactly. Exactly.
You know, yeah. The Americans probably did the targeting. And who knows? For all we know, the damn thing was fired from Azerbaijan by some U.S. forces, and Ukraine is providing a cover story because Azerbaijan doesn't want to get drawn into war with Iran. I mean, there's any number of possibilities here. At the end of the day, I'm sure that all of this is being orchestrated by Washington, and it just shows the fact that they're willing to drag Ukraine into the war with Iran is that these people are not anywhere close to understanding how dangerous a situation this is and how badly this is going to end for the entire global economy, including the United States. They're not close to understanding that. And I fear that the only way, as I said, is Iran. I've been saying this publicly on my program because I think it's the only way to bring this to an end. Iran and Ansarallah need to keep the Straits of Hormuz and Bab al-Mandeb closed right up until the midterms, in my view. And then, and perhaps only then, will the United States government be forced by the outrage of the American people to bring this travesty, this criminal war of aggression, to an end. But I think all the rest of it for now is just theater. Like when Trump says, as he did at the very moment that Brent crude hit $100 a barrel again, that was on Friday, at that very moment, he says, oh, I want to talk. I want to have a parlay. This is perhaps the Iranians are, you know, desperate. We've heard this countless times, of course. And what happens? The price of Brent crude falls below $90.
Yeah, I've long given up listening to what Donald Trump has to say. I mean, obviously he's speaking to the moneyed class here. He's not speaking to the people, as it's already been pointed out on this program. This is a wildly unpopular war. All right, David, we have a little bit more than a minute, and I'd like you to finish it off here. Where do we go from here?
You know, Donald Trump, it was under his first term that they were willing to send weapons to Ukraine to try to get this war going in the first place, which Obama, for all his hundreds of flaws, was not willing. And Trump is not to be trusted on not escalating these things. In recent days in the U.S. corporate media, they've been thanking the Ukrainians for blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline that initially was Russia's fault, right? Russia did it. It was the first story. And they went over a period of many months from Russia did it to not only the Ukrainians did it, but of course they did it. They should have done it. It's heroic. Thank them. They shouldn't, you know, Germany should be praising them, not prosecuting them, and so forth. And so, you know, people's memories are very, very short. And I'm not sure Trump's exists at all. And he's got himself surrounded by people who do nothing but push for escalation, escalation, and they're all going to go glorify Lindsey Graham and then try to be like him. This is a very, very dangerous situation. We should not imagine that because it looks like such a failure, they're going to end it.
I think, David, you're so right. Failure only gives them initiative to keep going, to double down and to triple. Absolutely. They don't learn anything, okay? What they do is give me more money and let's take another shot at it. And the results are absolutely disastrous. And I think Dimitri's right. It's going to be a revolted home over the economy and just the reaction to a deteriorating global economy. That's the only way. You can't deal with these people intellectually or use a reason. They're antithetical to that. On that depressing note, that's all. I want to thank my guests in Charlottesville and in Montreal. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.